Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week we'll be talking with poet Megan Burns, whose new book is Sound and Basin. We'll also talk with Randy Fertel, who's celebrating the 10th anniversary of the Ron Reidenauer Awards, and Seth Rosenfeld, who received that award for his book Subversives. And we'll catch up with Rick Barton, who's celebrating the 20th anniversary of his novel Black and White on the Rocks. Megan Burns is a busy lady. With Dave Brinks, she runs the weekly 17 Poets Literary and Performance Series, and she's kind of a poetry midwife. She edits the poetry magazine Solid Quarter, and she's the publisher of Trembling Pillow Press. She's a prolific poet herself. Her most recent book is Sound and Basin, a collection that travels the depths of New Orleans waters. And she recently had her first art show of poetry dolls at 1239 Congress. Megan, welcome back to The Reading Life.
Thank you for having me.
This is such a rich collection, and you found so much to explore in the waters around us. So tell us about the title poems, Sound and Basin, and how they brought you to the title of this collection.
I was thinking about intersections because I knew I still wanted to write about the city of New Orleans. I still had some poems sort of left over from my first collection. I was still kind of writing out of that post-Katrina book that I did with Memorial and Sightlines. And so I thought the city... Of course, there's Basin Street. I was thinking about waters. There's Chandelier Sound, which I write about in the book. And just that intersection of waters crossing and being so integral to our landscape and geography.
There's also this kind of tension between the fluidity of water and the spareness and whiteness of bone in this collection as well.
Yes. For some reason, I have quite a fascination with bones and anatomy. I think post-Katrina, the idea of infrastructure became very important to me, and kind of the anatomy of a city, that idea became very important to me. And so in this book, I tried to get some of that idea into this, the kind of bare boneness and what holds up a space is in there.
I think a lot of people in New Orleans are fascinated with bones. I really do. I mean, the bone gangs, everything. Mm-hmm. It's all throughout our culture. And you also have several poems in this collection that commemorate the BP oil spill as well. How hard was it for you to go back to that and to write about that?
I didn't actually go back to it. Around the one-year anniversary of the oil spill, I set out this project for myself, and it started about March and went all the way until August. And I wrote every day longhand, 4 or 5 pages about waters, about the Mississippi River, about the Gulf. It was just this long project of being totally concentrated on the water around us and how it influences our lives and impacts our lives. And then from that, I pulled this section where I became really concerned with the media interest in this anniversary. Having seen what happens around Katrina anniversaries, I thought it'd be interesting to write through how the media comes back and kind of looks at the area and has a concern and then kind of recedes and no longer is concerned. And yet the people in the landscape have to deal with all the fallout of that.
Right. It's like a wave.
Yes, yes, it is.
Now, one of the poems that I love the most is The Little Room, which you've dedicated to Walter Anderson, that wonderful artist of the Mississippi Gulf Coast. And I think many New Orleanians are going to recognize the emotions in this poem because it's all about that little room in the Walter Anderson Museum, isn't mm-hmm. it?
It actually came to the CAC when they did the Walter Anderson exhibit. Mm-hmm. They did a replica. So that's where this poem kind of comes from.
And did you spend a lot of time there?
I loved that exhibit. I was fascinated by it. And then, of course, had to read about him and everything that he did. And I just find him amazing.
So. He's one of my favorite characters. A New Orleans native, of course. Mm-hmm. So would you read that for us?
I will.
Thanks.
The Little Room, after Walter Anderson. If every corner holds 1,000 lifetimes, and in this one my hand lay like an anchor, if ever there were stars I saw were stars before I knew them, and what we called all names, and then you think of beauty. But I've a mind to keep on looking, as if hard enough, and then I found it. And I have an ache that fits inside a smaller space, so you can see how those three colors would infect me. It's almost the shape of a door I'll never get through, a light so real you'll feel it turning, and then I see, like you before me, and even our hands are not resembling one another's, so how can I know anything by touch? I find a way, my eyes do focus, and if it's clear here, I'll hide it in my mind. They'll say you called, we knew that they were stars before we saw them. The light that spilled around the door where you have buttoned down your skin. We walk in and back into a room to keep on looking. A little door with you behind there who would answer. And if we knew the word to speak a language that could reach you, we break in. The left window pane of plastic carries around my face from where I'm stealing. Have found that walls come to each other and then another. Until surrounded, I try the door, let light escape out. That's when I realize and then I follow before I know you. They say that stars are stars before we see them and not by the time their light has reached us. I watch the life I thief like a hand that holds me and caught we dance dead stars a day for dreaming. My mind says yes and goes without me.
Oh, I love that. Thank I love you. I thief like a hand that holds me. I love that so much.
Thank you.
Now, there's a lot of maternal imagery in these poems as well. You know, you have three wonderful kids.
Yes.
And I think it's sometimes you must be swamped by kid life, you know? And you've written about New Orleans as a mother in this city. The city is a particular kind of mother informed by dreams. How are all those things working together for you?
I think the reason it took me so long to write about the BP oil spill was because I just had my third child right when it happened. She was born in January, and then the event happened 3 months later, pretty much. So I remember actually breastfeeding her and watching that oil spill camera that just showed the gushing and thinking, this is the world that we've brought our children into, that we're kind of watching it going extinct. So I felt very hopeless at that time, which is why I couldn't write until almost a year out. Trying to figure out post-Katrina, post-Gulf disaster, how do you navigate that space and bring children into the world and give them some kind of hope? And I feel very mothered by New Orleans. It is my city. It is this place that I will never leave, and I'm happy to be here. And I think that the only thing that we can give people with language is the kind of the tools to remember that there is something to witness and say and have something to push against that kind of hopelessness that comes with all the things that we kind of continue to see even to today.
Mm-hmm. And you also wrote a very moving poem about Helen Hill.
Mm-hmm. I didn't know Helen, but I was back in New Orleans by that time, and she was a mother, and I was a mother. In fact, something about disasters, I seem to have children right around disasters, so I actually had my second child in January of 06, right after Katrina.
Wow.
So I think somehow disasters and mothering is very linked to me, but also survival of that and bringing life into the world. But yeah, I was very struck by her story, and it's one of those things that I think should just kind of be said and bear witness to and hold it, hold a space for it in our world.
This feels like a particularly kind of hard-won collection. Does it feel like the hardest stuff you've ever written?
No, it doesn't. It feels very vast to me because it moves mm-hmm. from that Katrina space all the way through the Gulf space. And then in the end, I did try to put some pieces that were a little more hopeful and a little lighter, and it just feels like a time-wise, a very vast collection.
And you're thinking about that when you're putting together a poetry collection. You're thinking about the reader moving through it in that way, aren't you?
Yes. I'm very aware that I can tackle very, very dark, very difficult subjects. So I think, too, it's nice to have that balance of some sort of light at the end.
And well, it's a beautiful balance and an amazing collection. So we've been talking with Megan Burns, whose new poetry collection is Sound and Basin. You can meet her Wednesday, May 15th, at the Open House Salon at 1501 St. Rock, and again Sunday, May 19th at 3 p.m. at the Maple Leaf Bar. Thanks so much, Megan.
Thank you, Susan.
My guests today are Randy Fertel and Seth Rosenfeld, who are united in a common cause, truth-telling in the public interest, brought together by Randy's memory and tribute to his friend Ron Ridenour. Ridenour was a New Orleans journalist who broke the story of the My Lai massacre in a 1969 letter to Congress. He died in 1998 at the young age of 52. To honor his friend, Randy came up with a lecture series in his name, then joined forces with the Nation Institute to establish prizes in the spirit of Ron Ridenour, awards devoted to recognizing journalists and writers and filmmakers and public figures who pursue the truth, often at great personal cost. The 10th annual Ridenour Awards were presented in April in Washington, D.C. Randy Fertel is in the studio with us today, and Seth Rosenfeld, who received the Ridenour Book Award for Subversives, the FBI's War on Student Radicals and Reagan's Rise to Power, is joining us by phone from San Francisco. Randy, welcome to The Reading Life.
It's good to be here.
And thank you, Seth.
My pleasure.
Randy, the first full decade of the Ridenour Awards is really something to celebrate. I wish you'd take a moment and look back at some of the highlights.
Well, yeah, it's been a terrific 10 years. We started giving the Courage Prize, which is kind of our Lifetime Achievement Award, to Dan Ellsberg, the whistleblower of the century, I guess. And we gave the Truth Teller Prizes, which is for something that happened in the previous year, to Ambassador Joseph Wilson, who had written the letter to the New York Times talking about what he didn't find in Niger, the yellow cake uranium. So he did his best to keep us out of the Iraq War. So we've had terrific winners. We've just a flawless list of winners. Cy Hirsch was our second winner, the Courage Prize, Gloria Steinem, President Carter, Bill Moyers, Bob Herbert. So it's been terrific.
So, Seth, tell us, I mean, this award has honored so many incredible books. And what was it like for you when you found out you'd won this award?
Well, I was absolutely thrilled. It's really a great honor to receive this award in Ron's memory. To me, Ron represents the highest order of truth-telling as a whistleblower, as a citizen, and as an investigative reporter. So it's really a great honor for me.
Now, your book, Subversives, the FBI's War on Student Radicals and Reagan's Rise to Power, tells the fascinating story of government surveillance on student radicals and involvement in university affairs at the University of California at Berkeley. And it centers on the lives of then-Governor Ronald Reagan, Berkeley University President Clark Kerr, and student radical Mario Savio. And the story unfolds at Berkeley and beyond during this time of incredible change. And the book began when you yourself were a student at Berkeley in 1981.
Yes, I was a journalism student at Berkeley, and my editor at the campus newspaper asked me to take a look at some FBI files that the paper had received under the Freedom of Information Act. In reviewing those files, I realized there was more to the story, so I submitted a greatly expanded Freedom of Information Act request. I figured I would get the files in about a year, write up the story, and go on to the next project. I had no idea I was embarking upon what would become a 28-year legal odyssey in which I would bring 5 lawsuits under the Freedom of Information Act, that the FBI would spend more than $1 million trying to suppress those records from being released, but that ultimately 7 federal judges would order the FBI to release more than 300,000 pages showing the FBI's extensive covert operations at the University of California during the Cold War. The FBI had been very deeply involved in university affairs. The FBI tried to get the president of the university, Clark Kerr, fired because bureau officials disagreed with his personal political views or his policies on handling campus matters. And I also knew that the FBI had a secret relationship with Ronald Reagan, going back to the 1940s when Reagan was an active informer in Hollywood. So I was trying to get the most complete story I could, and that's what kept me going all those years.
But it's so jaw-dropping. I mean, you read along and there are these stories like crawling under someone's house to listen to them and falling asleep. I mean, just, you know, there's some unintentionally comic moments, I guess, but it really is staggering to see it all add up, don't you think?
I was astonished at the extent to which the FBI was involved in university affairs. The FBI had informants at every level of the campus community, from the students to the professors to the administration and even the Board of Regents. The FBI was engaged in a staggering array of covert activities that included unlawful burglaries of people's homes, warrantless searches of their businesses, surveillance, maintaining people on secret lists by which they would be detained, again, without warrant during a time of an emergency. And beyond surveillance, extensive efforts to disrupt and neutralize people because they were involved in political activity with which the FBI officials disagreed.
Right. And one of the things that interests me is that you continue the story to the end of their lives. You know, Clark Kerr lived to be 92. Mario Savio died relatively young, kind of tragically, don't you think? And they feel so alive to the reader as you depict them. They're rich, full, committed people, you know. I'm curious to know, because this was your home school, you know, this was your turf and your history. And I'm wondering if any other universities received that kind of attention from the FBI during that turbulent time, do you think?
I do. I think the FBI was involved in surveillance and harassment of student activists and professors who were activists at almost every college and university in the country during the 1960s. One of the things that made the University of California a unique case is the fact that it's one of the largest and leading public universities in the United States. It had been involved in the development of the atomic bomb during World War II, so there was a very intense national security aspect to the university's role in society. And at the same time, Berkeley was the scene of some of the first and largest student protests of the 1960s. So there was this very clear contrast between national security on the one hand and civil liberties on the other hand.
Well,
and Reagan was down the road using this as a catalyst for his rise.
So, Randy, yeah. I want to ask you, when you read the books for the Ridenour Award, what are you looking for? Are you looking for lessons from the past that we need to learn for the present? What are you looking at?
First of all, we're looking for great writing, writing equal to Ron's. Ron was a terrific writer. And then impact, you know, we're looking for, you know, there's a kind of 60s theme to the Ridenour Prizes, and so this fits that to a T, but it's not a necessary element. So, you know, we're looking for books that display the courage to tell the truth and that have a certain impact.
Well, 28 years, Seth, that's really kind of an amazing commitment to a book. We've been talking with Randy Fertel, who's one of the founders of the Ridenour Awards, honoring his friend Louisiana journalist Ron Ridenour, and Seth Rosenfeld, who won the Ridenour Book Prize for his amazing work, Subversives, The FBI's War on Student Radicals and Reagan's Rise to Power. For more information, check out Ridenour.org. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you, Susan.
Thank you very much.
Rick Barton directs the Creative Writing Workshop here at the University of New Orleans. He's the author of several novels, The El Cholo Feeling Passes and Courting Pandemonium, and an essay collection, Rowing to Sweden. Today, he's here to talk about his work as a writer and teacher. The occasion? The University of New Orleans Press is about to reissue his novel With Extreme Prejudice under the title Black and White on the Rocks. Hi, Rick. Welcome to The Reading Life.
Hi, Susan. Good to be here with you.
Oh, welcome back to your old stomping grounds, more
I know.
Particularly.
Many years in this studio.
Now, Black and White on the Rocks was originally published as With Extreme Prejudice.
Correct.
And it was 20 years ago.
Yeah.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, it is amazing.
So what led you to go back to this work, and did you do anything with it for this new edition?
I didn't do a whole lot. John Irving used to read sometimes, and he would not read the text. I heard him do it with Garp, and we're following along. And we asked him afterwards, well, you didn't exactly read what was in the book. And he said, well, nothing's ever finished.
So, so true.
So, you know, I did some re-editing, but I certainly didn't try to reimagine it at all.
What was it like for you to read it after all this time?
It was pleasant. I mean, I enjoyed reading it again.
I've often wondered what it would be like to read something I wrote 20 years ago, but I have. And I usually do with great affection.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of, oh, really?
Yeah. Well, you do sort of remember where you were in your life when you wrote it, what desk you were sitting at and what office you had at that time. So it brings back those kinds of memories, I suppose.
Well, Black and White on the Rocks pulled on a lot of aspects of your life and thinking about New Orleans. And your work here, there's a lot of movie reviewing in this novel.
Yeah.
So what do you think gives it a staying power?
Well, I hope that New Orleans is a major character in the book. I try to look at New Orleans with all of its warts, and I think a lot of those warts are still there. The city is both celebrated and examined for its flaws, and I think that's probably the main thing that stays. It's also a book about a man who loved his wife very, very much and lost her at a fairly young age, and he's struggling mightily with grief, and that seems to me to also be something that endures.
And grief is the great subject nowadays, it seems to me, in memoirs and in fiction. Over and over again, I think we see it. So 20 years on, and here you have a new publisher. So what's it like to work with your own UNO Press?
Well, we have a new managing director in Abram Himmelstein. He's a terrific guy, knows a whole lot about small press books, and he's been really wonderful to work with. We also have several of our CWW, that's Creative Writing Workshop, students who work as interns at the press and were involved in some of the decisions in terms of cover design and layout and that kind of thing, and they're just wonderful young people, so it's a joy.
So folks at the Creative Writing Workshop get to learn not only about perfecting their craft, but about publishing as well.
That's correct. If they have internships at the press, they get that experience. We also publish a national magazine, Bayou, and they can work on that, and many, many do. And so they get firsthand experience at magazine publishing as well.
So the Creative Writing Workshop has been around since 1990. And you were in on the very beginning of this.
That's right.
What do you think has attributed to its longevity, and where do you see it right now?
Well, I think right now its highest point. We had 189 applications to the program for about 20 to 25 seats. We've had applications from all of America's best schools, Ivy League schools, Stanford, Reed College, Williams. We have Cambridge, England, Australia, South Africa. So it's really wonderful to see the interest that young aspiring writers around the world now have in coming to join this program. It is a very heavy burden on our faculty to make the decisions on who gets a seat and who doesn't. It's daunting work.
I can imagine. And how does your writing life impacted by teaching? It's taken a toll, hasn't it?
Well, it does. I mean, I think that's true of practically anyone who earns a living in the academy. You know, you have two things that you want to do. You want to teach well. You want to relate to students. You want to make sure that they get the best possible education that your skills have to give to them. And that's simply time out of the day. And so you're going to write less.
Now, you've written one book since Black and White on the Rocks, A House Divided.
I've published one book. I've written another one that I'm trying to sell right now.
Oh, good. That's what I was going to ask you. Yeah. What's the work in progress? Yeah.
The work in progress is a book called In the Wake of the Flagship. And it is told by a 17th century Indian named Metacom, who is very angry at the way in which he's been portrayed by historians for the last several centuries. And because he says that the historians have never gotten his story right, he's now going to tell it himself. And that's half of the story. The other half of the story is that he was very fond of a writer that we first met in the El Cholo Feeling Passes named Richard Janus, who set out at one time to tell Metacom's story. And so Metacom says, Janus should have told my story. He's the one that would have gotten it right. But he didn't, and he went off and became a basketball coach. So I'm going to sort of fill you in on his story. So Metacom tells his own story, and he also tells Janus' story after the end of El Cholo.
Oh, I love it when things come full circle that way. That's great. It's good you have more time to write, you know? It's like, you've written so beautifully about Katrina, and we've talked about it a lot. And there were those fabulous anthologies that UNO Press did, you know, the Voices Rising anthologies. And, you know, I would have thought that would be what you'd do next. It's interesting.
Something on Katrina?
Yeah.
Well, at the end of El Cholo, Janus moves to New Orleans.
Ah, yep.
Janus goes through Katrina.
Okay. It's amazing. We'll never leave that behind, will we?
I don't think so. I mean, not for a long time. I think every one of us has got at least one major story in him or her to tell. So,
and I think that's been one of the great stories about the Creative Writing Workshop and the press, that comeback after Katrina, that determination and sense of community and forward motion, don't you think?
Well, absolutely. I remember the one night in probably late October of 2005, we were teaching online, but there were some of us. Barb Johnson was in that class, and she was living nearby. And we all got together at the Parkview Tavern on North Carrollton one night, in which the city was just almost dead black. And the Parkview was one of the few places of light. And it was like a reunion, the students and the couple of teachers who were able to get out there and just sort of hold each other's hands and wonder what was coming next.
Right. It was an amazing time. I'm glad we all made it through. Well, we've been talking with Rick Barton, who directs the creative writing program here at UNO. And you can meet him when he signs Black and White on the Rocks Tuesday, May 14th at 5:30 at Garden District Bookshop, Old Home Week. Thanks a lot, Rick.
Thanks, Susan.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Today's guest, Rick Barton, signs Black and White on the Rocks Tuesday, May 14th at 5:30 at Garden District Bookshop. The West Bank Writers Group meets Tuesday, May 14th, and again Tuesday, May 21st, both at 6 p.m. at Barnes & Noble West Bank. Jill McCorkle signs Life After Life, Thursday, May 16th at 5:30 at Garden District Bookshop. And there will be a public reading by the winners of the Bad Poetry Contest. That's Thursday, May 16th at 6 at Ladder Library. Mel Coyle and Quo Vadis Gexpro and Asali Devon read Thursday, May 16th at 8 at the Goldmine Saloon. That's part of 17 Poets Literary and Performance Series. Nell Dickerson signs Porch Dogs, Friday, May 17th at 5:30 at Garden District Bookshop. The Louisiana SPCA will be on hand with adoptable dogs, and there will be a doggy kissing booth. Alex Beard signs The Crocodile's Tears, Saturday, May 18th at 11 at Octavia Books. Science fiction writer Brandon Sanderson signs his new young adult novel, The Rhythmatist, Saturday, May 18th from 1 to 3 at Maple Street Bookshop, Uptown. Peggy Franklin and Susan Tucker sign Women Pioneers of the Environmental Movement, Sunday, May 19th from 2 to 4 at Garden District Bookshop. Today's guest, poet Megan Burns, reads from and signs Sound and Basin, and poet fiction writer Jimmy Ross reads from and signs Say What, Sunday, May 19th at 3 at the Maple Leaf Bar. David Gilham signs City of Women, Monday, May 20th at 5:30 at Garden District Bookshop. Bill Lofelm signs The Devil in Her Way, Tuesday, May 14th at 6:30 at Maple Street Bookshop in the New Orleans Healing Center, and again Tuesday, May 21st at 6 at Octavia Books. And coming up, the Saints and Sinners Literary Festival for gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgendered writers, readers, and book lovers. That takes place May 23rd through 26th at the Hotel Monteleone. Watch for great writers like Dorothy Allison, Bernard Cooper, Felice Picano, Justin Torres, and many others who will be presenting their work. Check out sasfest.org for more information. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.